A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's been dealing with digestive issues since his gallbladder surgery 7 years ago, and the most persistent problem is bloating after meals. But here's the twist that caught my attention. He gets uncomfortably bloated even after just drinking water. He's been in some surgery recovery groups where people insist this comes down to vagal nerve damage from the procedure. Meanwhile, some doctors say that's impossible. That during a laparoscopic gallbladder removal, there's no way the vagus nerve could be injured, and certainly not permanently. So he's asking, is that really the case? And if nerve damage is in play, what can you actually do to live well with the body you've got?
This is such a good question, and it sits right at the intersection of what surgeons will tell you and what patients actually experience. I want to start by saying, the doctors who claim vagal nerve damage is impossible during a laparoscopic cholecystectomy are technically correct in a narrow anatomical sense and also completely missing the point.
That sounds like the kind of technically correct that gets you uninvited from dinner parties.
It really is. So let me walk through the anatomy, because once you see it, the whole debate makes more sense. The vagus nerve, the 10th cranial nerve, runs from the brainstem down through the neck, into the chest, and then through the diaphragm into the abdomen. By the time it reaches the gallbladder area, it's split into two main trunks, the anterior vagal trunk and the posterior vagal trunk. These run along the esophagus, pass through the esophageal hiatus in the diaphragm, and then branch out to innervate the stomach, liver, gallbladder, pancreas, and intestines.
When the surgeon is in there with the laparoscope, where are these nerve trunks relative to the gallbladder?
That's exactly the right question. The gallbladder sits tucked under the liver on the right side of the upper abdomen. The main vagal trunks are more midline. They're running along the esophagus and then branching to the stomach. During a standard laparoscopic gallbladder removal, the surgeon makes four small incisions, inflates the abdomen with carbon dioxide, and works in the area of the gallbladder fossa. The main vagal trunks are not in the direct surgical field.
The surgeons are right. They're not anywhere near the big nerve trunks.
And that's what they mean when they say vagal damage is impossible. They're thinking of the main trunks. But here's what they're not accounting for, and this is where the patient experience becomes really important. The vagus nerve doesn't just have two big trunks. It has an entire network of smaller branches, including the hepatic branch, which comes off the anterior vagal trunk and runs to the liver and gallbladder. These smaller branches absolutely are in the vicinity of the surgical field.
Vagal nerve damage might be the wrong term, but damage to branches of the vagal nerve is a different story.
And it gets more complicated. There was a paper in Surgical Endoscopy a few years back that looked at this directly. The researchers found that during laparoscopic cholecystectomy, the hepatic branch of the vagus nerve can be affected by several mechanisms. Thermal injury from the cautery device used to dissect the gallbladder from the liver bed. Traction injury from pulling on the gallbladder during the procedure. Or even inadvertent clipping if a branch runs through an area that gets secured.
Thermal injury from cautery. That's the tool that burns through tissue to stop bleeding?
It generates heat, and that heat can spread beyond the exact point of contact. If you're cauterizing near the gallbladder fossa, and a small vagal branch runs through that area, you might get what's called a thermal spread injury. The nerve branch isn't cut, but it's essentially cooked. And nerve tissue is extremely sensitive to heat.
Of course it is. So you don't need to sever a nerve to cause problems. You just need to get it hot enough.
And here's where the water bloating becomes relevant. The vagus nerve is responsible for something called gastric accommodation. That's the stomach's ability to relax and expand when you eat or drink. When food or liquid enters the stomach, the vagus nerve signals the smooth muscle in the stomach wall to relax, allowing the stomach to expand without a corresponding increase in pressure. If that signaling is impaired, the stomach doesn't relax properly.
You drink a glass of water, your stomach doesn't get the memo to loosen up, and suddenly you feel like you've eaten a Thanksgiving dinner.
That's the mechanism. And water is actually a really interesting test case because it contains no fat, no protein, no fiber, nothing that would trigger a gallbladder-related digestive issue. If you're bloating after plain water, it's pointing toward a motility or accommodation problem, not a bile or fat digestion problem.
Which is exactly why the Facebook group theory about vagal damage makes intuitive sense to people, even when their surgeons dismiss it.
And I want to be careful here, because I'm not saying every case of post-cholecystectomy bloating is vagal nerve damage. There are several things that can cause bloating after this surgery. But the water test is a pretty strong signal that we're looking at a functional or neurological issue, rather than a purely digestive one.
Let me push on this from the other side for a moment. If these hepatic branches can be damaged, why isn't this more widely acknowledged in the surgical literature? Why the blanket denial from so many surgeons?
A few reasons. First, the hepatic branch of the vagus is not something surgeons routinely identify or preserve during gallbladder surgery. It's not considered a critical structure the way the common bile duct is. So if it gets damaged, nobody's looking for it and nobody's documenting it. Second, the symptoms of vagal branch damage, bloating, early satiety, gastric discomfort, are what medicine calls functional symptoms. They don't show up on a CT scan or an endoscopy. The stomach looks normal anatomically, so there's no objective test that says, here is the nerve damage.
No test means no diagnosis, and no diagnosis means the problem doesn't officially exist.
That's the frustrating reality of functional gastrointestinal disorders. And third, there's a genuine gap between the surgical literature and the gastroenterology literature on this. Surgeons report complication rates based on things they can see and measure. Bile duct injury, bleeding, infection, hernia at the incision site. The gastroenterologists who see these patients years later are dealing with a different set of problems.
The surgeon's definition of a successful surgery and the patient's definition of a successful outcome are measuring completely different things.
That's the fundamental tension. I saw a study from the American Journal of Gastroenterology that followed patients for 5 years post-cholecystectomy. About 40% reported persistent gastrointestinal symptoms, with bloating being one of the most common. But if you look at the surgical complication rate for laparoscopic cholecystectomy, it's reported as less than 5%. The gap between those numbers is enormous, and it's mostly filled by things that don't count as surgical complications.
40% versus 5%. That's not a gap, that's a canyon.
It really is. And some of that 40% is probably unrelated. People who had underlying functional issues before the surgery or who developed new problems independently. But some substantial portion of that gap almost certainly represents effects of the surgery that aren't captured by the standard complication framework.
Let's talk about what vagal damage would actually mean in practical terms. What does the vagus nerve do in the digestive system beyond stomach accommodation?
The vagus is the main highway for parasympathetic signaling to the gut. It controls gastric acid secretion. It regulates the pyloric sphincter. That's the valve between the stomach and the small intestine. It coordinates the migrating motor complex, which is the housekeeping wave that sweeps through your gut between meals, and it modulates visceral sensitivity, meaning how your brain perceives what's happening in your gut.
If you damage even a branch of this nerve, you're potentially disrupting a whole cascade of coordinated functions.
And the body has some redundancy and plasticity. Nerves can partially regenerate, other pathways can compensate, but the system is complex. One thing I find particularly interesting is the effect on the pyloric sphincter. The vagus helps regulate when it opens and closes. If that regulation is off, you can get delayed gastric emptying or, conversely, dumping syndrome. Both can cause bloating just through different mechanisms.
Dumping syndrome. That's when food moves too quickly from the stomach into the small intestine.
And it's actually a recognized complication of vagal nerve disruption, though it's more commonly discussed in the context of vagotomy, which is the deliberate cutting of the vagus nerve as a treatment for ulcers. But the principle is the same. If your vagal signaling to the pylorus is impaired, the coordinated release of stomach contents gets disrupted.
We've established that nerve damage is anatomically plausible, even if it's not damage to the main vagal trunks. Let's get to the second part of the question. If this is what's happening, what can you actually do about it?
This is where I want to be honest about the limitations. If you have nerve damage, we don't have a drug that regenerates vagal nerve branches. But there are approaches that can meaningfully improve quality of life, and they work by either compensating for the lost function or modulating what remains of the signaling system.
Give me the practical list. What does someone actually try?
First, and this sounds almost too simple, but meal pacing and volume modification. If the stomach has impaired accommodation, you want to avoid overwhelming it. Smaller, more frequent meals. Not drinking large volumes of liquid with meals. Sip instead. The goal is to keep the intragastric volume within a range that doesn't trigger discomfort.
You're manually managing what the vagus nerve would normally handle automatically.
It's behavioral compensation for a neurological deficit. Second, there's some interesting work on diaphragmatic breathing and vagal tone. The vagus nerve runs through the diaphragm, and deep belly breathing, the kind where your diaphragm really moves, can stimulate vagal outflow. There's decent evidence that regular diaphragmatic breathing exercises can improve gastric accommodation and reduce bloating in patients with functional dyspepsia.
Is this one of those breathe deeply and your problems will melt away things, or is there actual physiology here?
There's actual physiology. The vagus nerve carries both afferent and efferent fibers, signals going to the brain and signals coming from the brain. Diaphragmatic breathing mechanically stimulates the vagus as it passes through the diaphragm, and it also shifts the autonomic nervous system toward parasympathetic dominance. It's not a cure, but it's a tool, and it's one of the few things patients can do themselves that has at least some evidence base.
What about medications? Anything that specifically targets this kind of functional bloating?
A few options, none perfect. Prokinetic agents, drugs that stimulate gut motility, can help if the primary issue is delayed. Gastric emptying. Metoclopramide is one, though it has side effect concerns with long-term use. Domperidone is used in some countries but isn't approved in the United States. There are newer prokinetics being developed, but they're not widely available yet.
Those work by stimulating whatever residual nerve function is still there.
Others work directly on the smooth muscle or through different receptor pathways. Another class worth mentioning is neuromodulators. Low-dose tricyclic antidepressants like nortriptyline or amitriptyline. These aren't being used for depression at the doses we're talking about. They're used because they modulate visceral hypersensitivity. If part of the bloating sensation is your gut nerves being oversensitive to normal distension, these can dial down that sensitivity.
That's an interesting reframe. It's not that the bloating isn't real. It's that the nerve signaling is amplifying normal sensations into pain and discomfort.
That's a crucial distinction. The bloating is real. The distension is real. But the brain's interpretation of that signal can be modulated. There's also some emerging interest in transcutaneous vagal nerve stimulation, TVNS, where you stimulate the auricular branch of the vagus nerve through the skin of the outer ear. It's non-invasive, and there are devices being studied for everything from epilepsy to depression to gastrointestinal disorders.
You can stimulate the vagus nerve through your ear?
There's a small branch of the vagus that innervates part of the external ear. It's called the auricular branch, or Arnold's nerve. By placing an electrode on the skin over that area, you can send electrical signals that travel back up to the brainstem and then down through the vagal efferent pathways to the gut. It's not mainstream yet, and the evidence for gastrointestinal applications is still preliminary, but it's a fascinating area of research.
We've got behavioral strategies, breathing exercises, prokinetics, neuromodulators, and ear electrodes. What about dietary approaches?
This is where it gets individualized. Some people with post-cholecystectomy bloating do well with a low FODMAP diet, not because FODMAPs directly relate to gallbladder function, but because they're highly fermentable carbohydrates that can cause gas and distension in anyone. And if your stomach accommodation is impaired, you're going to feel that distension more acutely. Others find that reducing insoluble fiber helps, because fiber adds bulk and slows gastric emptying.
Which is counterintuitive, because we're always told fiber is good for digestion.
For most people, it is. But if your stomach can't accommodate volume well, a big salad might be the worst thing you can eat. It's all about matching the diet to the specific functional deficit. This is where working with a good gastroenterologist or a dietitian who understands functional GI disorders becomes really valuable.
Let me circle back to something. We've been talking about nerve damage as the cause, but is there a way to actually confirm that's what's happening? Or is this always going to be a diagnosis of exclusion?
Direct confirmation of vagal branch damage is extremely difficult outside of a research setting. You can do a gastric emptying study to see if the stomach is moving food through at a normal rate. You can do an electrogastrogram, which measures the electrical activity of the stomach. You can measure heart rate variability as a proxy for vagal tone, but none of these definitively say the hepatic branch of the vagus was damaged during surgery.
You're assembling a circumstantial case.
But here's the thing. That's true of many neurological conditions. We diagnose migraines based on symptoms, not a nerve biopsy. We diagnose functional dyspepsia based on symptoms and exclusion of structural problems. The absence of a definitive test doesn't mean the condition isn't real.
The water test is actually a pretty compelling piece of evidence in that circumstantial case.
It really is. If someone gets bloated after drinking plain water, and this started after gallbladder surgery, and other causes have been ruled out, vagal branch dysfunction affecting gastric accommodation is a very reasonable hypothesis. It may not meet the standard of proof a surgeon demands, but it meets the standard a thoughtful clinician should consider.
I want to ask about the permanence question. The prompt mentioned some doctors saying the damage couldn't be irreversible. What's the actual regenerative capacity of these nerve branches?
Peripheral nerves can regenerate, but it's slow and often incomplete. The hepatic branch of the vagus is a peripheral nerve, so in theory, if the damage is from traction or mild thermal injury rather than complete transection, there could be some recovery over time. But we're talking months to years, and the regeneration may not restore full function.
If it was a thermal injury from cautery?
Thermal injury can cause a range of damage from temporary conduction block to permanent axonal loss. If the nerve sheath is intact, regeneration is more likely. If the nerve is completely destroyed in a segment, the odds are worse. And there's no way to know which scenario applies without surgically exploring the area, which nobody is going to do for bloating.
You're living with uncertainty about whether it'll ever improve on its own.
Which is why the practical approach matters so much. You can't wait around hoping for nerve regeneration that may or may not happen. You work with what you've got.
There's something I want to pull out here that I think a lot of people in these surgery recovery groups would recognize. There's a real psychological toll to being told by your surgeon that the procedure went perfectly, and there's no reason for your symptoms when you're experiencing very real discomfort every day.
The term for this is medically unexplained symptoms, and it's a phrase that does a lot of harm. The symptoms aren't unexplained to the patient. They're unexplained to the clinician who's looking in the wrong place with the wrong tools. There's a whole body of literature on the iatrogenic harm of dismissing functional symptoms.
Iatrogenic, caused by medical treatment itself.
And in this case, it's not just the physical effects of the surgery. It's the secondary harm of being told your experience doesn't count because it doesn't fit the diagnostic framework. Patients end up feeling gaslit by their own doctors.
Which probably drives them deeper into the Facebook groups, where at least someone believes them.
And those groups can be a double-edged sword. They provide validation and community, which is genuinely valuable, but they can also amplify misinformation and lead people down rabbit holes of unproven treatments. The ideal is somewhere in the middle, a clinician who says, "I believe your symptoms are real, here's what might be causing them, and here's what we can try, even if we can't prove the mechanism."
That clinician sounds rare and precious.
They're out there. They tend to be gastroenterologists who specialize in functional disorders or neurogastroenterology. The field is called neurogastroenterology, and it's exactly what it sounds like. The intersection of neurology and gastroenterology. These are the people who think about the gut's nervous system, the enteric nervous system, and its connection to the central nervous system.
The enteric nervous system. That's the so-called second brain in the gut.
And it's fascinating. The enteric nervous system contains something like 500 million neurons, more than the spinal cord. It can operate independently of the brain and spinal cord, but it's heavily modulated by the vagus nerve. So when you damage vagal branches, you're disrupting the communication between the central nervous system and this massive neural network in the gut.
That disruption can manifest as bloating, among other things.
Among many other things. Bloating, altered bowel habits, early satiety, nausea, abdominal pain. The range of symptoms reflects the range of functions the vagus modulates.
Let's get really practical for a moment. If someone is listening to this and thinking, "This sounds like me," what's the actual sequence of steps they should take?
First, rule out the things that can be ruled out. See a gastroenterologist. Get an upper endoscopy if it hasn't been done. Rule out H. Pylori infection, celiac disease, small intestinal bacterial overgrowth. SIBO, which is actually more common after gallbladder removal because the continuous trickle of bile can alter the small intestinal environment. Get a gastric emptying study if delayed emptying is suspected.
Don't just assume it's vagal nerve damage and skip the workup.
The water bloating is a strong clue, but it's not a diagnosis. Second, if the standard workup is negative, ask about functional disorders. Specifically, ask about functional dyspepsia, which includes postprandial distress syndrome. That's the subtype characterized by meal-related bloating and early satiety. The Rome 4 criteria are the diagnostic framework for these conditions.
Rome 4. That's the classification system for functional gastrointestinal disorders?
And it's important because it gives these conditions diagnostic legitimacy. They're not wastebasket diagnoses. They have specific criteria. Postprandial distress syndrome requires bothersome postmeal fullness or early satiety at least 3 days per week for 3 months, with symptom onset at least 6 months prior. It's a real diagnosis.
Assuming you get that diagnosis, what's the treatment pathway?
It's typically stepwise. Start with lifestyle and dietary modifications, the pacing, the smaller meals, the diaphragmatic breathing. If that's insufficient, consider a prokinetic or a neuromodulator. Some clinicians add in a trial of a proton pump inhibitor, even if there's no evidence of acid reflux, because acid suppression can reduce visceral sensitivity in some patients. If those don't work, there are more specialized options. Gastric electrical stimulation, acupuncture, cognitive behavioral therapy for the brain-gut axis.
Cognitive behavioral therapy for bloating.
It sounds strange, but there's good evidence for brain-gut therapies in functional GI disorders. The idea isn't that the bloating is psychological, it's that how your brain processes and reacts to gut sensations can amplify or dampen the experience. CBT and gut-directed hypnotherapy have been shown to reduce symptom severity in functional dyspepsia and irritable bowel syndrome.
Gut-directed hypnotherapy. I feel like we need a whole episode on that.
It's fascinating, and the evidence base is stronger than most people realize. There are randomized controlled trials showing it's as effective as the low FODMAP diet for IBS, with better long-term adherence.
Let me bring this back to the nerve damage question specifically. If the hepatic branch of the vagus is damaged, does that also affect gallbladder function in some ironic way? Like, you've already removed the gallbladder, but does the nerve damage create additional problems with bile flow?
That's a really interesting question. The hepatic branch of the vagus does innervate the liver and the biliary system, including the sphincter of Oddi, which controls the flow of bile and pancreatic juices into the duodenum. If that branch is damaged, you could theoretically have sphincter of Oddi dysfunction, either too tight or too loose. Too tight, and bile backs up, causing pain and possibly contributing to bloating. Too loose, and bile flows continuously, which can irritate the small intestine.
The nerve damage could be causing problems through multiple pathways simultaneously. Impaired gastric accommodation, altered pyloric function, and disrupted bile flow regulation.
That's probably why these cases are so hard to untangle. It's rarely one clean mechanism. It's usually several interacting dysfunctions. The body's systems don't fail in isolation.
There's a philosophical dimension to this that I keep coming back to. The prompter asks about living as best you can with the body you have. That's a fundamentally different framing than, how do I fix this?
I think it's the healthier framing, honestly. Not because you should give up on improvement, you shouldn't, but because accepting the reality of a changed body reduces the psychological suffering that comes from constantly comparing your current state to your pre-surgery state. You're not trying to get back to who you were. You're trying to optimize who you are now.
That sounds like something you'd say to a patient.
I said versions of it many times over the years, not always in those words, but the sentiment. The body you have right now is the only one you're going to get. Your job is to work with it, not against it.
What about the role of time? The surgery was 7 years ago. At that point, is there still potential for improvement, or are you mostly in management mode?
7 years out, spontaneous nerve regeneration is unlikely, but that doesn't mean improvement is off the table. The nervous system retains plasticity throughout life. You can train new compensatory patterns. You can modulate the signaling that remains. You can reduce the secondary factors, like visceral hypersensitivity, that amplify the primary problem. People do get better even years after an injury.
It's not about waiting for the nerve to heal. It's about building a better operating system on the hardware you've got left.
I'd add one more thing. Don't underestimate the value of finding a clinician who takes you seriously. The therapeutic alliance, the relationship between patient and doctor, is itself a treatment. Patients who feel believed and supported have better outcomes, even when the specific interventions are the same.
Which brings us back to those Facebook groups. They're filling a gap that the medical system has left open.
And I have complicated feelings about them. On one hand, peer support is valuable, and patients sharing their experiences can surface patterns that the research literature hasn't caught up to yet. On the other hand, these groups can become echo chambers of despair, where people reinforce each other's hopelessness and promote treatments that range from unproven to dangerous.
The algorithm of nobody believes us can curate a pretty dark feed.
The healthier version is a group that says, we believe you, and here's what we've tried, and here's what helps some of us, and here's where to find a doctor who gets it. That's a very different energy.
Let's talk about one more thing before we start to wrap up. The prompt mentioned gastritis as well. Is there a connection between vagal dysfunction and gastritis, or are those separate issues?
They can be connected. The vagus nerve stimulates gastric acid secretion. If vagal signaling is disrupted, acid secretion can become dysregulated, either too much or too little. Too much acid can contribute to gastritis. But there's also a reverse connection. Chronic gastritis, especially if it causes pain and discomfort, can alter vagal signaling through visceral hypersensitivity pathways. The gut and the brain are in constant conversation, and inflammation in the gut changes the content of that conversation.
It's a bidirectional mess.
It's a bidirectional mess, and that's actually the unifying principle of neurogastroenterology. Everything talks to everything else. You can't isolate one part of the system and treat it in isolation.
If you had to give someone a single piece of practical advice for navigating this, what would it be?
Keep a detailed symptom journal for at least 2 weeks. Write down everything you eat and drink, the timing, the volume, and the symptoms that follow. Note the severity on a simple scale. And also note context, stress levels, sleep quality, physical activity. Patterns will emerge that you can't see when you're just living through it day to day. That journal becomes a tool you can bring to a clinician and say, look, here's what's happening. This isn't random.
The data is more persuasive than the anecdote.
And it also helps you feel less crazy. When you can see the pattern on paper, it confirms that what you're experiencing is real and systematic, not something you're imagining.
That's a good place to land. There's a lot here. The anatomy, the controversy, the practical strategies, and I think the core message is that the Facebook group theory and the surgeon's dismissal are both too simple. The reality is messier and more interesting, and acknowledging that messiness is the first step toward actually managing it.
The water test is underappreciated as a diagnostic clue. If you're bloating after water, something neurological or functional is happening. That's worth investigating, and it's worth finding a clinician who understands why it matters. And now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1780s, Tasmanian Aboriginal groups practiced a form of full-contact wrestling that involved coating the body in eucalyptus oil and red ochre, a tradition entirely lost after colonial disruption, with the last known practitioner dying in 1814 without passing on the techniques. Historians only rediscovered references to it in 2023, buried in the unpublished journals of a French naturalist who witnessed a match and described it as the most slippery contest of strength I have ever beheld.
Slippery ochre wrestling? Of course there is.
I have so many questions, and I know I'll never get answers.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop, for somehow finding that fact and deciding it belonged in this episode. If you want more of this, you can find every episode at myweirdprompts.com. We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head,
send it in, we'll chase the thread.
My weird props, that's the close from sloth, from man, from long ear host.
My weird props, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.